RCR with Paul Brennan. Reality Check Radio.
Jeffrey Tucker is an American libertarian writer, publisher, entrepreneur, and the founder of the Brownstone Institute. Jeffrey's been on our program quite a few times now. It's always great to catch up with him. And we thought we'd get him back for an examination, let's say, of the psyche of the American voter, what Trump is setting out to do, and some other issues. Jeffrey, it's great to have you back.
It's a pleasure to be here. Thank you.
How are you feeling?
Well, you know, after Tuesday, I was ecstatic, and it was, of course, wildly exaggerated, but I let myself feel it just because it's been about 4.5 years since I felt any kind of happiness whatsoever. So, I mean, you know, about public life. So I think it's good, and mostly good. The appointments that have come down today have been a little bit depressing, like not quite right. what the voters were asking for, you know. I'm not prepared to say all is lost. I think we're going to get some good domestic appointments. But also serves as a bit of a reminder that this revolution has to be a people's revolution, and it's not going to be fully realized from the top, even with the wisest leadership.
Okay, so Nikki Haley and Pompeo, Trump telegraphed quite clearly a day or so ago on the timeline of this chat, he ruled them out. So he obviously knew that wasn't going to fly.
Yeah, that was a lot of public pressure there. But, you know, the Trumpy movement is probably better than Trump. I mean, that's typical in politics, that the movement beneath is better than the leadership, you know. And so there's a lot of screaming about Nikki Haley and who was this other person you said?
Pompeo.
Pompeo, former CIA guy. And so they got shattered down, and that was that. But then he picks this Rubio punk, you know, who's just this old Washington hand warmonger, you know.
How would Rubio have got to that?
My guess is through mutual financial connection, something like that, and attachments, Middle East attachments, you know, of a well-known sort. But it's a problem because, on one hand, you know, you want to dial back the U.S. empire. On the other hand, you've got strong interests in certain outcomes in highly disputed regions of the Middle East, and I'm not sure how you have both at the same time. But anyway, I'm trying not to obsess about that. But today was mostly bad news. I'm hoping that for the next 4 days, we're going to see some really strong appointments, some really shocking appointments in domestic politics and health and food and in medicine and education and some of these other areas. So, and you know, politics is always about trade-offs. So those might be good trade-offs. But nonetheless, I do think it's important to remember what happened on Tuesday, which was genuinely a people's revolution against the elites. And by the elites, I mean the entire distribution coalitions that had come to control most of the U.S. and most of the West and most of the world, actually. This strange combination of government, NGOs, major globalist corporations, together with a media empire, right? So that and with that comes, you know, a roping in of pharmaceutical companies, medicine, and everything, you know, and academia. Okay, so you put all that together into a big pot and stir it, you get something I would just call the power elite, you know, or the managing heights, the managerial class. And what this election is a rare glimpse into what people actually think on Tuesday. And, you know, you can even leave aside Trump, which I don't think you really can, but let's just pretend for a second. His persona represented a revolt against the elites, a rejection of everything they're telling you to believe, and an opportunity to give the establishment a black eye. And people went out and did it. You know, they had tried everything against them, lawfare and, you know, wild accusations of this and that and the other, and distorting all of his words all the time and claiming that right before the election, they claimed that he was calling for the murder of Liz Cheney, which is absurd.
Yeah, we saw that. Yeah. Yeah. Again, it was a manipulated, sort of edited piece, wasn't it?
It's always the case. And same with the claims that he was obsessing about Kamala's race. That's not what happened, you know. I mean, so and you know, we have ears to hear and eyes to see. You know, we're not blind by the media because we have, you know, we have X and we have, you know, we have access to original documents now, and vast numbers did, and people voted for Trump in part because they thought he was going to be so disruptive. He may yet be, but we'll have to see. But I also think there's a real danger here. I'm not sure we call it a danger, but the fulfillment of a historical narrative that we've typically seen in revolutionary situations is that there's usually a transitional government. We saw it in 1776. We had a transitional government in the form of the Articles of Confederation before they gave us the Constitution. We saw it in 1789 with the First French Republic that became the Robespierre province that landed in Napoleon. We saw it in the Bolshevik Revolution. The overthrow of the Tsar led to a transitional government, and eventually the empowerment of the Bolsheviks sought in Germany with the Weimar first, you know, the first German Republic, the Weimar Republic that was eventually brought Hitler to power. So, you know, what does this working class revolution lead to? I think it's impossible to say, but one thing's for sure. Trust is not going to come back in the mainstream media. It's not going to come back in medicine. It's not going to come back to the bureaucracies or the expert class in academia. It's all gone. So, and trust in Trump, you know, it's going to last until it doesn't last, right? I mean,
yeah,
you know, yeah. So these kinds of appointments like Marco Rubio, whatever, it's not encouraging. Now, like I say, it could just be a political payoff. But I think the great challenge that the Trump administration faces is to stay ahead of the of a revolution and lead it rather than get trampled by it. And that could, in fact, happen.
Hmm. I saw a clip of Marco Rubio calling Hamas animals to the camera. And while that may be a debatable point, what do I know? That's hardly diplomatic at this stage of the game, is it? If you want to bring people together, he nailed his colours to the mast big time right there. I want to talk about there's Susie Wiles, who's now the chief of staff, and she's campaigned and represented companies through PR, etc. But first, just sticking with the voters, we'll get to that just right after this. Hasn't this election revealed an anomaly for 2020 where Trump wins the popular vote by quite a margin, yet he's still, I think, got 10 million less votes than Biden did in 2020. Now, there's only, two answers for that? Either Democrat voters stayed at home at that number, or there are 10 million votes from 2020 that don't make sense. Is anyone talking about that?
Yes, everyone's talking about it, and it's gravely embarrassing for the establishment, for the media, for the Democrats, because for 4 years, Trump has been screaming that the election was stolen, and it's been very embarrassing, and he's insisted that you agree with him or else you couldn't be close to his team, and then everybody outside of the team said, no, that's not right, the election was not stolen, you're just a poor, sore loser, you're kind of a poor sport and that sort of thing. But in polite society, you could never say the election of 2020 was fraudulent, but the Team Trump looked at the numbers back in the day and said, this is not possible. You know, it's not possible that Trump could have garnered more of in the popular vote than he did in 2016, still lost. And then suddenly, and there were, I don't know, 10, 15, 20 million votes just appearing out of nowhere in 2020. They were mostly, of course, mail-in ballots that were permissioned by the COVID response. And so they knew 4 years ago that all they had to do was crack down to make voter fraud more difficult. That was their main agenda, right? Make the voter fraud more difficult. And they did, you know, and they knew that the math was with them, too big to rig, as they used to say, stop the steal. And so they got a lot of voter IDs laws passed in red states, and a lot of policing of polling stations in blue states, and then inspired a new, the most disenfranchised voters of all, which were young men under 40, to get out and vote for him, because that's why he was on the Bro podcast and everything like that. And then developed a mass movement, a kind of a cultural movement, to blunt the impact of Kamala's influencer campaign, you know, with all the big stars coming out and going, oh, you know, support Biden, support Kamala. And that three-pronged approach worked. It worked like math works.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah.
get rid of the fake votes. Whatever fake votes you can't get rid of, you replace with newly enfranchised voters, and then and attract young people with a kind of a viral media campaign with MAGA hats and so on, and 2-3 times a day rallies all over the country. And it worked like a charm. The people who were least surprised by the outcome was the Trump administration. But it's deeply embarrassing for all those people who've denied the existence of voter fraud in 2020, because it's very difficult to explain otherwise. I mean, there are truly 10 million missing votes. And, you know, I've spent the whole day reading about this stuff. They say, oh, there's still going to be votes coming in from California. Oh, there's this. And then another point they make is that a lot of the missing votes belong to blue states. Well, yeah, exactly. That's exactly right. So, it's very difficult to know. And people have asked me this for 4 years. Like, do you think Trump lost legitimately? And I've always just said that, you know, I don't know. I'm guessing so, but I'm not enough of an expert to say for sure, you know. And my friend Dinesh D'Souza has tried to document the existence of voter fraud, but it's been very difficult. I tell you what really rattled me was about 3 weeks ago at a Brownstone Supper Club. We had a speaker by the name of John Baudouin, who's kind of an expert on legal standing. And he pointed out something I did not know, which was that every challenge to the 2020, or every court challenge to the 2020 election was back from the courts on grounds of standing. Whereas they were never heard.
And that's interpreted as it never, you know, had any legal success, but it never got to even the starting grid or whatever.
No, you can turn down anything on standing. I mean, that means we're not going to hear the case. That's what it means. And I don't know how you reject something like that on standing. I mean, because every single voter has standing.
Especially when some of it's on video and captured, you know, clearly.
Yeah, so it just means that it was never properly went to trial. That's what that means. And now we have this grave embarrassment that of the missing 10 billion votes, essentially. And it makes you think we've had, essentially an illicit presidency for 4 years, which is just something unbelievable. And it also makes you wonder about other things, that most of the states that Kamala won were states without voter ID.
Yeah, no, I was going to mention that too. So that sort of that doubles down the suspicion in a way, if you're putting things together.
Yeah, it sure does. And so one wonders, you know, how long election fraud and ballot fraud and fakery has been a problem in the United States. There's no question that, and here's the thing, if it's been a problem for a very long time, it very well could be that one of the purposes of the pandemic was to enable mail-in voting. On grounds that you can't stand in line at a polling booth because that'll give you COVID. So, and we know for sure that March 12th, 2020, the CDC announced that everybody should do mail-in ballots, right? So this, and it's well-known fact that mail-in ballots are associated with fraudulent ballots, and that's been true for known for generations all over the world. So, you know, that this must have been an intended outcome, is all I can say.
When the holes in the Swiss cheese line up, you got to take notice of that, right? Okay. I mentioned Susie Wiles just before. First, I think, female chief of staff. Okay, you might want to make a comment about that. Also, RFK is in a czar position. Do these czar positions actually mean anything?
Perhaps. It's not entirely clear how much. Well, like right now, the cabinet positions and the political appointees and all this kind of stuff essentially have no power over the bureaucracy at all. So the first job of the Trump administration is going to be to rein in the civil service. If they don't do that, nothing's going to matter.
Get rid of the stay-behinders, I think they're called, aren't they?
Well, there's two million plus people like that, you know, in the civil service that have been running the government for my entire life and really long before. So these people are the government, and everything else is just window dressing. So if Trump wants to be president, he's got to get rid of him. Now, what I'm hearing on the ground is 4 years ago, Trump administration tried to pass an executive order that would have reclassified about 50,000 of the 2 million as so-called Schedule F, meaning they're subject to being fired or they're at will employment. And there was panic in Washington about this. And so there's talk, you know, in the last couple of days, he's going to bring back Schedule F. But from everything I'm hearing from within the Trump campaign, we're long past over that. That was very much 4 years ago. Now the intention is to reclassify the whole of the civil service, the entire thing, and make it entirely go away, like completely, so that there will be no more job security in any position associated with the federal government at all. So, yeah, for anyone, the entire civil service, so-called, is going to be abolished. And that, I think, would be a very good step.
That's huge, isn't it, actually?
If that happens, that'll be the biggest change in American politics in 150 years.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah, but that's what they're talking about, and I don't think Schedule F's even on the table. The other thing that's extraordinary about having won the Senate and the House is that if Trump handles this well, he can convert essentially the abolition of the civil service from an executive order into actual legislation, so that we get a piece of legislation, short piece of legislation, that just wipes out civil service completely.
And that's the more solid way to go, I take it.
That's a much better solid way to go, because then you can't have a federal judge come in and enjoin against it and say, oh, that's unconstitutional, you can't do that.
Which
is what they often do with executive orders, right? So with legislation, I mean, truly, if the House and Senate pass it and the president signs it, anything can happen in the United States. I mean, there's no existing law that prevents the House and Senate and the president, when they're working together, from overriding it.
Yeah, wow. Well, that is, that's big. I want to get to, before our time runs out, Jeffrey, to what happens now with Ukraine, number one. It's been reported that Trump and Putin had a phone conversation, though others are saying, and Peskov, the spokesperson for Putin, say, no, it didn't happen, it's fiction. But Trump has been claiming that he can solve this in a day. Maybe he can. Zelensky's looking more and more spooked. The German government is in disarray, and Trump is not that friendly to NATO, especially in regards to who finances it. So what do you think is going to be the pattern there, Jeffrey?
I don't think Trump needs to make any phone calls at all. Yeah. He just needs to cut off the money. That's the end. I mean, without the money, peace will take over Ukraine you know, and Russia. They'll come to a negotiated agreement. That war only existed because the U.S. is funding it. Otherwise, it would have. I mean, there's a legitimate political conflict in the eastern part of Ukraine over the presence of Russian nationals and the feeling that they're being unjustly imposed upon by Kiev. So that's the kind of issue that would normally be resolved through diplomacy. And it would have been solved long ago and saved a lot of lives if the U.S. hadn't thrown a bunch of money at funding it, you know. And so just turning that from 10 to zero solves that problem instantly.
You can do that in a day?
Yeah, you can do that in an hour. I mean, that's absolutely nothing. So that'll be solved. As for NATO, you're right. The Trump administration doesn't care anything about it. And this is where I guess I'm a little concerned about this Rubio rat being a Secretary of State. On the other hand, he is a real... He's just a wet rag, really. I mean, he's not real. So he'll go along with whatever Trump says. And Trump's kind of a, you know, I mean, he's got some status, right? He's got some got some clout. So we have to go along with Trump. Trump hates NATO, and Bobby Kennedy, who exercises a lot of influence, and Musk has. So here's the way it goes. Trump is the goat, right?
Yeah.
And then right under him, is Musk, and right under him is RFK. Okay, so that's the way it goes. And then right under that is everybody who gave to the campaign, you know, 10 million and up, right? So that's just the way it goes. And the Musk hates NATO, and RFK hates NATO. So, and I tell you this, what my read on what I'm seeing and what I'm hearing is that the Trump administration is going to be more friendly to the BRICS nations than it is to NATO as a military alliance.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Because they have to? Because that's a big...
No, because they hate, they hate the French. I mean, they hate the French. They hate NATO. They can't stand it. It's disgusting.
So NATO's gone, is almost what you're saying, potentially.
I think so. I think the Trump administration sees them as a bunch of parasitical social democrats who use American tax dollars to censor free speech and go around promoting socialist Green New Deal bullshit. I mean, that's the way they look at NATO. They have no respect for anybody in NATO. So, but they do have respect for Xi Jinping, for Putin. Not that they like these guys, but as you know, Trump respects strength, and BRICS is showing strength. And so, there's another advantage here. Not to belabor the point, but the U.S. needs some way to dislodge itself of its financial obligations to the world. Being the world reserve currency is going to cause permanent trade difficulties for the U.S. Permanent. We will never be able to retain any manufacturing so long as the U.S. is the world reserve currency. I mean, that's just the way the economics of it mean that every country in the world can export to the U.S., with very cheap products that are made better than anything in the U.S. And that means the U.S. will never get a production foothold in anything other than energy and debt, you know, and that's just where we are. Energy, debt, and ill health. That's our main thing we produce. Right?
Exports.
So those are our three main exports, right? So we've got to convert that. And if that means BRICS picking up some of the load, and with its very interesting little scheme for either developing a basket of a commodity basket that they use as a, you know, kind of a blockchain currency among themselves, or possibly adopting gold, or just all the individual BRICS nations asserting their own currency rights over each other, you know, all those things are options, but they're all looking for options to the dollar. And despite Trump's bravado about, oh, you better better not give up the dollar. You got to keep the dollar. I mean, that's it's a problem for the U.S. to face this weird obligation, especially if you're going to have an America First policy. You want the dollar strong at home, but not necessarily dominant relative to every other currency in the world.
Got about a minute or two left, Jeffrey. Just want to ask you about this. Iran seems to have come into the chatter more than just what's going on in the Middle East, but you know, apparently they're targeting Trump and all these things have been said. So you wonder why, if that's actually really happening or why that is being talked about as it has been very recently. He's got to deal with the Middle East, and Rubio's made his thinking clear. I mentioned that earlier. So how does Trump unbundle that? And if I was sitting in Iran right now, should I be worried, you think?
The Iran-Israel issue is the wild card in the deck, unfortunately, right now. The only thing that I'm kind of hoping on is that Trump really hates war. And I think this is really the core of who he is. He can't stand war. He hates it. He doesn't mind assassinations, by the way. And doesn't mind
Soleimani.
And so on. But he really hates prolonged war. He doesn't want to send Americans anywhere to do anything. So he likes being the boss, but he doesn't want war. So I think he's going to urge some kind of brassy negotiations, you know, for some kinds of settlements over Iran, what they perceive as Iran's funding of Israel's enemies and so on, so on. So now, the last term, he sent out Kushner to do these deals. I don't know who he has to do that. Maybe it's going to be Rubio, which sounds like a joke to me. But I'm hoping that we can get some peace here and that we're not hurling ourselves towards war. I'm more optimistic about peace in Ukraine and also within China and its sphere of influence. The Middle East is a problem area, and I'm not entirely sure how they're going to solve that. Obviously, the Trump administration has zero sympathy at all for any land rights claims in the region, except for Israel's, which I think is potentially problematic. It didn't help the Hamas supporters, disrupted American campuses and have allied themselves with the far left and this kind of stuff, right? So so that then it becomes like this weird ideological issue. Nonetheless, the idea that Trump wants to go to war for Israel, that's just not true. He does not. Yeah. So I hope we get to see peace in that area too.
All right. Also, one thing I didn't mention in our chat here, quarantine camps, re-CDC story, become aware of that. I don't know if we've got time for that.
Yeah, I wrote about that in order to inspire the Trump administration to do what they should do, which is abolish the CDC. Like, there is no saving this agency. So I'm hoping that he does not appoint a head of the new CDC, of the CDC, that there is no head of the CDC, that CDC is abolished in one stroke. Boom. Done. I wrote that article because I found the document, and I think it was the first time I'd seen it, but I wrote it with the intention, well, I should say not with the intention, but the hope that that Trump administration will just strike its line out on the budget.
Jeffrey Tucker, always great to talk with you. Thanks for making the time, and it won't be our last chat, I hope. Until next time, thank you.
Okay, thank you.
The RCR shop has great gift ideas, from great-looking tees, hoodies, caps, tote bags, bumper stickers, and more. The RCR shop is now open at www.realitycheck.radio/shop.